Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Marcy Krivenin. Voters in Aspen this week turned down a new lodge proposed on Main Street. Now the developer is moving forward with an alternative.
Yeah, we have a couple other options already drawn, and we would just start going down that path and, you know, getting back in front of HPC and starting the process all over again.
With fresh snow, mountain roads are closing and buses are getting outfitted for skis.
Western Slope officials are making their message clear about the statewide water plan.
We contend, we on the Western Slope, that there is no more water to divert. We already are diverting a very large amount of water every year.
And a proposed development in El Jebel has officers realizing there isn't enough law enforcement in the area.
Gorillas in the museum? The Aspen Art Museum unveils new exhibits. One features animals from Cameroon.
Finally, students at Glenwood Springs Middle School consider what they want to be when they grow up.
That's all coming up on Mountain Edition right now.
The developer behind a proposed lodge on Main Street in Aspen said Tuesday he would not be surprised if voters turned down Base 2, and that's exactly what they did. 63% voted against the lodge proposal on the corner of Monarch and Main Streets.
The issue, called Question 2A on the ballot, was polarizing, with many saying the lodge was a step toward progression. Others said it broke city rules and didn't fit in. I spoke with the developer Mark Hunt before the results were released Tuesday. First, I want to ask you a little bit about the energy around this issue leading up to Election Day. Did you expect this much interest in Question 2A?
I did not. I'm actually shocked by it.
It seems like there were a lot of young people rallying around support for Base 2. You know, how did that evolve?
Well, I think it's certainly part, you know, reaching out to the younger generation, but I also think it has a lot to do with the type of product. I think they can relate to it, where there's so many projects that happen in Aspen that, quite frankly, it's hard for that generation to relate to or get that interested in.
Well, and we, of course, did a couple stories on campaign finance. We noticed that the campaign for Base 2 spent some money on beer and pizza. Can you buy the vote with beer and pizza, or was that to create sort of a groundswell of support and make people feel like part of something bigger?
Well, I think it was really to get the vote out. I mean, I keep hearing this beer and pizza. You know, we really haven't bought that much beer or pizza. You know, we had an event at Rhino's where we were really just pushing to get the vote out. It was not Base 2 specific.
And would you be surprised if you lost?
Not at all. Not at all. No, I mean, I think this is a tough one. I mean, I think in this environment, I think, you know, there's a lot of energy around this, and certainly a lot of energy with, you know, people that have been here for a long time with different views. I quite frankly would be pretty shocked if we won, you know, but I am very interested in hearing what the people have to say. And I've always said from the beginning that it's not necessarily a win or lose. It's more of, you know, because I'm happy from, you know, my developer hat on, I'm happy, you know, either way that it goes. I've always said I was really inspired by Base. Certainly because of that, I would love the opportunity to build it here. But I think that, you know, the most important thing to me is really just getting as many voters as possible, you know, out there to get a pretty good, you know, understanding of truly what the community wants.
You know, if you lose, I mean, do you have plans already drawn up for a commercial building?
Yeah, we have a couple other options already drawn, and we would just start going down that path and, you know, getting back in front of HPC and starting the process all over again.
Again, if the commercial building was moving forward, do you plan to ask HPC for no setbacks on that building?
No, I mean, I think we'd be very similar to the Base 2 Lodge, you know, where I know there's this misconception that there are no setbacks, but, you know, as Base 2 is designed and approved, there are setbacks on every side of the property. It makes a lot of sense just from urban planning that it would hold the corner. We would certainly ask HBC to do that again. It would not be a variance.
And when would you submit those plans? You know, when might people see a new building in that space?
I would guess that we would finish our land use application within 2 or 3 weeks.
And that would be for the commercial building?
Correct.
Have you talked to potential tenants for a commercial space?
We have, yes.
That's sort of plan B, and you're already moving in that direction.
Yes, well, I mean, it all started out as plan A. I mean, you know, I'm a commercial developer, you know, doing retail, and that was really kind of plan A when we purchased the property. And then we were asked to, you know, explore some of the city's needs. So we changed our plan and focused and came up with the concept of Base Lodge, both Base 1 and Base 2, and got sidetracked a little bit. So it certainly wouldn't be, you know, a shock to go back to our original plan.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marcy.
Mark Hunt is the developer behind the proposed Base 2 Lodge in Aspen. The hotel will not be built after voters decided against it Tuesday.
Another issue Aspen voters weighed in on Tuesday was what to do with the City Hall building, also called the Armory.
It was the closest up-valley race, with just 51% of voters choosing community use over city offices.
Now, a group creating plans for a community center is moving forward. They'd like to return the building to its roots.
The Armory Community Center group cheered Tuesday when about 1,400 voters marked the community use option on their ballots. The advisory vote won by just 86 votes. City Council put the question to voters ahead of plans to consolidate city offices. In Tuesday's vote, residents indicated they would prefer city staff move out of City Hall to free up the building for a community center. Up until the 1950s, it was the Armory building, used as a roller rink, political rallying space, and more. Developer Bruce Etkin is behind the effort to draw up plans for the space. He's committed $100,000 toward the effort. He says the vote is heartening.
It propels us forward. It gives us a standing, and more importantly, it gives us an opportunity to work with the entire community, to listen carefully to their wants.
Next, his group will research how much it'll cost to renovate the building and look at funding sources. City Council still needs to approve a community use, though it's given initial support. The council is scheduled to discuss the vote on November 16th.
Independence Pass closed 2 days earlier than planned, thanks to a winter storm that blanketed Aspen and brought snow to area ski resorts.
CDOT's Tracy Truelove says the closing of the alternate entrance to Aspen is an encouraging signal for many locals.
It's always one of those bittersweet things, I think, because we realize it's a beautiful highway. But for the skiers, it's usually a good sign that things are starting to get a lot more snow and it's time to shift our resources.
With the winter gate closed, two sets of sweeper vehicles made a last-minute pass to make sure no one was locked in. Last year, crews had to wait an hour for a cross-country skier who's not aware of the impending lockdown. The agency initially thought it could close the pass on November 6th.
The Roaring Fork Transportation Authority will soon be swapping bike racks for ski racks, Allison Bektesh reports.
During the last 2 weeks of November, RAFTA will remove bike racks from the front of each bus and, instead, place ski racks on the side of all of them. Riders are advised that during that time, there is no guarantee that their bus will have a bike rack. All buses will be transitioned out by Thanksgiving, Thursday, November 26th. On-season schedules also resume that day, increasing the number of local and commuter trips. Also, with the shortened daylight hours, bike loading times have been reduced. Riders may only load bikes between 7 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. because bikes block the bus's headlights. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Marcy Krivenin. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Before a deadline to finalize the Colorado Water Plan, elected leaders from the Western Slope are emphasizing their opposition to Trans Mountain diversions. The plan aims to find ways to supply water to the state's growing population.
In October, a petition signed by 1,500 Western Slope residents was delivered to Governor Hickenlooper, urging no new Trans Mountain diversions be included in the Colorado Water Plan. Then, at a meeting last Monday, Western Slope lawmakers reiterated the need to keep water in their region. Representative Bob Rankin was at the gathering in Glenwood Springs.
We contend, we on the Western Slope, that there is no more water to divert. We already are diverting a very large amount of water every year, and the Denver metropolitan areas and the farmers could always use more water. We on the Western Slope think there is no more water to be diverted.
In an October 20th Denver Post article, Front Range Conservancy districts that provide water to consumers said they want Trans Mountain diversion plans included in the statewide plan. Jim Pokrand contributed to the build-out of the plan. He chairs a group that focused on the Colorado River Basin.
Everybody got pretty excited about that Denver Post story, but it's not even clear where all those comments came from that looked like a pretty aggressive, like we're going to do a Trans Mountain diversion.
He says the Colorado Water Conservation Board assured him nothing radical, like a new diversion, would be added to the plan. The board is in charge of developing the plan. What was added is a goal for water storage, where reservoirs may be expanded or built.
But as some folks have said, you can build storage, but you can't store your way out of the problem. There are opportunities to store more water, but storage is certainly not a silver bullet.
The plan does mention some on-the-ground projects, but Representative Bob Rankin thinks more specificity is needed. Plus, the state aims to start raising $100 million annually starting in 2020 to implement it. Rankin wonders where the money will come from.
Is it user fees on water users? Is it a tax increase across the board? So that's a big question.
Pokrand says once the plan hits the governor's desk later this year, it's not a done deal.
There will be a chance to make more comment and edit it further down the road.
The plan is aimed at addressing a projected 163 billion gallon shortfall in the state due to climate change and population growth.
Major support for Aspen Public Radio's environmental reporting comes from the John Denver Aspen Glow Fund at the Aspen Community Foundation, promoting responsible stewardship of the lands and wilderness of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
A local conservation group has launched a fundraising campaign to preserve a piece of land used by the Aspen School District. The Marble Base Camp is at risk of being sold to private interests.
The 57-acre tract of land becomes an outdoor classroom every fall as part of the Aspen School District's Outdoor Ed program. Brian Hightower is a former teacher.
The entire eighth grade for going on 50 years has hiked through the Maroon Bells Wilderness, and they end up on day four at this place called Base Camp in Marble.
The land went on the market last year, but Hightower partnered with the Aspen Valley Land Trust, and the landowners agreed to take it off the market until the end of this year. AVLT has until then to raise $200,000 in private donations. Martha Cochran is executive director.
And if we're able to do that, AVLT would continue to own it. We haven't figured out the details, but we would lease it to the schools for $1 a year.
The parcel is an in-holding in the National Forest adjacent to the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness. If the money's raised, AVLT would place a conservation easement on it. About 4,000 students have used the Marble Base Camp. Development proposals in the mid-Roaring Fork Valley have prompted law enforcement officials to discuss whether more officers are needed.
The Basalt Police Department and Eagle County Sheriff's Office have been talking for a while now about staffing in the El Jebel area. The two agencies often trade off handling cases based on which has more officers on duty. Basalt Police Chief Greg Knott says 7% of his department's calls are on county land.
We're starting to spend a lot of time assisting Eagle County. It's sustainable right now, but as development moves in and with the possible projects that are on the horizon, I don't believe it will be sustainable.
Knott and Eagle County Sheriff James Van Beek say the two agencies are friendly, with current land use applications like the Tree Farm Project proposing hundreds of new residents. The two law enforcement chiefs and other officials recently met to assess whether more county law enforcement is needed. They came to the conclusion that the four rotating sheriff's deputies is not enough. Increasing that number is largely up to the sheriff's office. Van Beek says he's actively looking for more funding. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
The Aspen Art Museum will be opening new exhibits this week. The Contemporary Art Museum will unveil multiple installations throughout the month, including painting, sculpture, and video works both inside and outside the building. Aspen Public Radio arts and culture reporter Patrick Fort takes us on a tour.
The first stop was the Elk Camp Restaurant in Snowmass, where commissioned art has been placed in partnership between the museum and the Aspen Skiing Company. I rode up the mountain in the backseat of a Honda to meet Janique Smith, a painter based out of New York. She's in the restaurant by herself, and there are definitely some vibes of The Shining. Solitary work? Check. Big, quiet building on a mountain? Also check. Janique is painting on a large wall. It's about 30 feet long and 10 feet high, a scale that Smith enjoys working on.
I like to use my whole arm span, my whole body, and when you work large and on a wall like this, it gives you that freedom to work big and small, to make large gestures and more intimate moments within it.
There are long, broad brushstrokes coming from a central point in the space, gestures of pink and black paint that look to be an interpretation of the wind. But is it?
I have associations that come with each element and with each gesture, but that's not why I made it that way. I'm not illustrating one thing or another, and that people like yourself can bring to it their own meaning.
And meaning is something that she's very sure to instill in her paintings, regardless of what that meaning exactly is, or if it's even clear to the viewer. Her works are swirling paintings with collage elements thrown in. There are these things inserted to this work that seem to be pretty straightforward. Words scrawled in a gracefully nondescript manner, but upon further investigation, it's impossible to actually decipher their meaning. So what do they say?
I use the gesture as actually text, so it's abstracted text, and I'm using these bits of poetry that are inspiring the marks.
Words mysteriously written into the curls and billows of Shanique's marks, just clear enough to be noticed, but vague enough to remain anonymous. Off the mountain, back in Aspen, Diana Thayer's installation, Gorilla, 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 is allowing viewers to experience two worlds at once, very literally. In a dark room, projectors stream videos of gorillas onto the wall. There's also one animal whose image is being produced on 9 televisions stacked on top of each other into a square. The gorillas all live in a refuge in Cameroon, but the way she films the animals gives you the impression that some are wild. In parts of the footage, they sit by fences, and in other shots, they sit in trees or fields or with scientists, as they would in a National Geographic documentary. The images are arranged in a circular shape. 5 are projected on the wall and others appear on the floor. They stretch and are compressed as they bounce off the different angles of the room. You're drawn to the center of the images, where there's a space on the floor with nothing being projected. But once you're there, you can't see everything at once. Your shadow blocks the way. Diana says that's intentional.
You can never see anything all at once, so you're forced to move, which is another kind of address to the body, right? You need to move around the work in order to see the entire piece. You can't see all of it from one vantage point. So the point is to engage the viewer physically as well as, you know, mentally.
Being mentally engaged in your surroundings is something Diana focused on heavily. The glass doors and windows in the room, which let natural light come in, have been covered in green gels so that the entire space has a hue of that color. But one other striking part of the exhibit is the lack of sound. Again, another conscious choice.
I want you to be fully in the present, knowing that you're in a gallery. I don't want to have the sounds of the rainforest or the jungle piped in or, you know, on speakers, because I don't want to transport the viewer.
She says sometimes people leave her installations thinking that there in fact was sound in the room. There's a strong emphasis on placing people in a specific environment, in a specific mindset. She wants you to know that your existence is in two spaces, two places when you enter the room.
There's a space that you recognize and with which you're familiar, that's architecture, and there's a space with which you're not familiar, and that's wild and unstructured, and that's the rainforest where the gorillas live.
Her subjects over her career have ranged from dolphins and tigers to the abandoned Ukrainian city of Chernobyl. Gorilla, Gorilla, Gorilla was a commissioned work by the Natural History Museum in London to make a piece in celebration of the anniversary of the publishing of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. She's been using film as her medium for years because of the way that she believes animals perceive time differently than we do.
Film and video are sort of their time-based media, so they make meaning in time. And so I'm interested in watching and observing animals in time and seeing how they live their lives.
And seeing how people are able to interact with technology as they experience art, as the projectors and cables are scattered around the room.
I believe we have the ability to experience the sublime, the beautiful, the transcendent in the presence of technology. So I leave it all exposed, obviously. You know what I mean? I make it very obvious. The cords drop from the ceilings, they snake along the floor. So I make no attempt to hide it at all.
Nor does she hide her desire for people to understand two worlds at the same time. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
Jeremy Rieger is Senior Instructor of Vocal Coaching at the University of Colorado. His Eklund Opera Singers will be performing in Aspen at Harris Concert Hall and Christ Episcopal Church this week. Rieger spoke with Patrick Fort about performing new and old works, as well as bringing the show to different locations.
You perform a mix of traditional repertoire, classic songs that kind of everyone who does opera knows, but you also do a lot of newer, more contemporary things. What was the inspiration or reasoning behind doing that?
I think in the last couple of years, we've really seen contemporary opera as a place for young singers to emerge into the field. And so they've started over the summer this program called See You Now here, and they allow composers to come in and workshop operas with our singers, who are then paid over the summer to get the opportunity to work with some really established composers to help them refine the work before it moves on to an opera house.
So as I understand, this is the third year that the group has been coming to Aspen to do performances up here. What's it like for the group to travel somewhere to perform?
Oh, it's really exciting. Already I've seen the singers walking in the hall, and they're just a change of scenery is really useful, but also getting to perform for a live audience that doesn't see you all the time it brings this kind of excitement that we don't get here in school all the time. You know, when you're in school studying, it seems like everyone around you is doing the exact same thing. But actually, it's good to remember that what we do is extremely special, and we're creating moments that will never exist ever again when we've created those musical moments. So having an audience that we don't normally see year-round is really special for us.
All right, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Eighth graders are deciding between different professions as part of a new career mentoring program with the Glenwood Springs Middle School and a Carbondale-based nonprofit.
I attended a career expo for the program and filed the story.
Anybody know what a private personal trainer does? No? All right, does anybody go to PE?
About 60 students are gathered in this spacious common area at Glenwood Springs Middle School. Most are clustered at tables around the room, except the eight with personal trainer Mike Pierre.
So, the importance of exercise takes you all the way through life. You can range, when you're doing personal training, from everything from working with individuals to working in group fitness, right? Group fitness is a blast. It's like going to PE or it's like going to sports.
This station will quickly become the most visible in the room as Pierre leads his potential mentees into doing squats on a Bosu ball, sprints, and other athletic exercises.
So, Mike, tell me what you're doing here. What are you going to do with the next group?
I just keep pitching. We're just getting them into exercise, trying to get them into fitness, keep them going, get them strong and healthy. That's my goal.
And Pierre is showing kids that if they mentor with him, they'll see what it's like to run a physical therapy business. Heather Hicks is associate director with Youth Entity, the nonprofit that's running this career fair.
So the coaches are really selling their internships today to the students. It's a 3-minute pitch. It's sort of like speed dating.
Students have already taken a test to get to know what personality traits they have, like investigative or social. Many have several color-coded bracelets on their wrists, and they're looking for coaches who have the same bracelets as well.
They're all talking about their professions. Each coach is dressing the part and brought some props to make it as real life as possible.
The students will ultimately choose which professional coach to mentor with over the next month and a half. Besides Pierre, there's professionals ranging from veterinarians to chefs to other career paths.
What I'm noticing is there's a little competition between the coaches, and the ones that are making it more interactive with the kids seem to be really succeeding.
More specifically, most people in the room look a little distracted by the impressively energetic Pierre and his eight kids running back and forth.
Okay. Hello, you guys. I am a professional licensed cosmetologist. Does anybody know what that means? Go ahead. Cutting hair, what else?
Jill Hamrick is 3 feet away at the next table. She's fully battling it out for the attention of her students.
Carpal tunnel is becoming a big problem with cosmetologists. So now they've developed a little tool where you could twist your scissors so you're not injuring your...
Hamrick has an array of products, mannequin heads, brushes, and other tools of her trade spread out in front of her. And her efforts seem to be paying off. At least one potential mentee is 8th grader Talia Castillo.
I'm investigative, social, and enterprising. I think it's great. I mean, I'm really excited to try cosmetology and the food.
There are two chefs here, too.
I've always really liked to be in the kitchen and helping out my mom when she's at work. It's just something I'd like to be able to do.
Assistant Principal Sandy DeCrow laments not having a similar mentorship option when she was in school many moons ago. And she says this is especially helpful for kids as early as later this year.
They start to build their 4-year plan for classes they want to take in high school. They do that in order to get into the college they want to, so you kind of got to have an idea of what you want to do later on.
Over the next 6 weeks, students will meet each Wednesday with the professional coach of their choice. Okay. By the end of the program, they may have some answers to that lifelong question, what do we want to be when we grow up?
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. Have a nice afternoon. I'm Marcy Grivenen.
And I'm Elise Thatcher. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.